The following message is copyrighted by Westminster Theological Seminary. Duplication, distribution, or other use of all or any part of this message is not permitted without prior written consent. Please direct your inquiries to communications@wts.edu. For all other information, please visit the main website at www.wts.edu.
Yeah, that's good. There are a lot of good points to make about this on both sides of it. First of all, you notice that Bainton has somewhat negative attitude towards Calvin. That's more so than McNeil. For instance, the thing that it struck me in just reading over the material for today, when he talks about Caraffa, the leader of the Inquisition, who becomes Pope Paul IV, he calls him the Calvin of the Catholic Counter-Reformation. So that indicates a rather severe look at Calvin, understanding of Calvin. One of the things, though, that Bainton brought out in earlier reading, I think it was page 119, is what is termed the sumptuary legislation in Geneva. That is the laws that apply to things like clothing and food and daily life, dancing, recreations, all that sort of thing. He points out that this was not new in Calvin's time. This was medieval legislation. It already had existed in Geneva. Let me read that passage. With regard to all such regulations, well, let's see what he's specifically referring to. Within the city, an effort was made to introduce a rigoristic regime, which has often been the occasion of scoffing because it centered on what most people in a secularized culture have come to regard as trifles. There were penalties for having a fortune told by gypsies, for laughing during preaching, for making a noise in church, for passing tobacco during the service, for settling a bet on Sunday, for inability to recite prayers. Taverns were abolished and abbeys converted into hostels where no drinks were served on Sundays, during church hours on weekdays, for church was held on weekdays, nor after 9 o'clock at night. With regard to all such regulations, one must bear in mind that they were simply a continuation of the sumptuary legislation of the late Middle Ages, which the Calvinists, with their newfound energy, proceeded to enforce. So, in other words, there had always been a sense that Christianity militated against some of these activities and excesses in certain activities which might be legitimate otherwise. Calvinism did see God's, in other words, there wasn't a dichotomy between one's religious life and one's everyday life. He saw the Word and the Lord's authority extending to every aspect of life and thought, and that's important for us to realize. The danger, and Calvin spoke against this in part of what we looked at yesterday out of the Golden Book of the True Christian Life, the danger is the sort of thing I grew up in fundamentalism, where, and you have to think how it impacts children and young people. But I grew up in a fundamentalist Presbyterian context where, in terms of our daily life, the five don'ts were prominent. And this is what you tended to think summed up the Christian life. And it was things like don't drink, don't smoke, don't go to the movies, don't gamble, which meant even playing cards, with those black and red symbols and all, even if you played just for fun, that somehow those were evil too. And then what was the other one? Don't dance. And I remember mortifying experiences at the gym period in public school where I was the only one who wouldn't participate in the dancing. You see, as a young person, sat on the side feeling very conspicuous and so on. Now, I give my parents credit because they gave very positive reinforcement to these things and said, we do this because we want to honor the Lord. And so in a way, it was a part of my strengthening my testimony my sense of being different from the world. But often it was in rather trivial areas. By the way, we did go to movies. And that was a problem too, because if you went to a movie and saw other people from church there, what were you going to do? So, you know, your conscience was impinged on by all these things, and you had these rather trivial things became magnified out of all proportion. And it was rather easy to keep these things. There was a certain stage in my life where I said, no more movies, you know. I'm really going to be holy. And then you get all sorts of spiritual pride, and you're magnifying minor things and neglecting rather major things quite often that are a bigger part of the Christian life. It was even while I was in seminary that it helped me. Remember, Arthur Glasser came, who taught, one great missionary leader, who taught at Fuller Seminary's School of World Mission. And he spoke in chapel, gave a series in chapel at Covenant Seminary, where he said at one point, these things, these negatives, these aren't the Christian life. It was just good to hear somebody that you could respect say that. It was liberating. Well, that's, if I'd read Calvin earlier, I would have been helped much sooner. But there's that type of thing. So you do get the Calvinism that says that the Lord's authority extends to every area of thought in life. And that's important. But then to keep things in balance and proper priorities, as the Lord himself said, the weightier matters of the law. He commended the Pharisees for tithing all these little herbs and spices and everything, but they had neglected the weightier matters of the law, justice and mercy and things like that. So I think that's the lesson to be gained from it. When you look at Lutheranism and the Church of England is characterized much more by this too. The adiaphora. That's the phrase that's used. In fact, there were a couple of adiaphoristic controversies, particularly in Lutheranism, but then in Anglicanism too. Things indifferent from the Greek word. And in Lutheranism, there was a great stress that there are many, many things, and in Lutheranism, particularly this comes in the area of worship. The feeling was there are things that are indifferent. The word hasn't said one way or another, so we leave those as indifferent and we don't try to legislate them. Zwingli and Calvin, the Reformed tradition, in worship particularly, wanted to stress we want to be guided in worship by the Word of God in detail. Do only those things that are specifically given. If they're not authorized in worship, then we ought not to do them. That's part of the Puritan-Anglican battle in the Church of England. When we get into the origins of Puritanism and on into the 17th century, we'll see that that's part of it. But in the daily life, I think they're the Puritans, you know, the name Puritan in our American context has the connotation of somebody very strict and often, puritanical. That's the word has come, particularly with regard of matters of sexual concerns. And that's not the picture at all when you get acquainted with the Puritans. That's more Victorianism, 19th century attitude. The Puritans exalted, as the Song of Solomon and other parts of Scripture do, marital sex. Sex within marriage is one of God's great gifts. So it wasn't that at all, but they were indeed concerned to abide by God's will in every area of life. So you get these books of casuistry in the good sense, cases of conscience, to resolve cases of conscience, which really were an effort to liberate people. As the world was changing, we live in an age of rapid change in so many ways. Medical technology is one of the easiest examples to use. And I know Dr. Edgar deals with a lot of these things. We have to struggle to try to define when does death occur, for instance, and do we keep people on machines all the time? Because now something as simple as a nasogastric tube can keep somebody fed and with water. But there are many ways of keeping the blood system going where they might be brain dead. So we got to try to decide scripturally, theologically, when does death really occur? That's just one example of how technology produces rapid change. Well, in this era of the Reformation, the New World had been discovered. Printing was a recent thing. All kinds of changes that were shattering the old world views. And so people had many, many ethical questions. And they came to Puritan ministers like Richard Baxter and said, tell me, which is the better thing to do in this case? And he developed in his directory, Practical Theology, thousands and thousands of words with cases, how to use the scriptures to determine what is really right and what is wrong. So they were very helpful that way. So in a lot of those cases, Lutherans didn't worry about it so much. The Lutherans, the Sabbath is another good example. The Lutherans don't apply the fourth commandment in the same way. They would want you to gather for worship, but after that, you're pretty much free. Have a picnic, play ball, whatever you want to do the rest of the Lord's day. And the Reformed people were more concerned to set this whole day aside for God's worship and fellowship with God's people, study of His Word, so that, as the Westminster Standards say, only deeds of necessity and mercy should be employed, and those recreations that are legitimate on other days should not be entered into on the Lord's Day. So you can see the degree of difference there between the Lutheran and the Reformed tradition in areas like this. Scott? If you've studied the contemporary theonomists, Christian Reconstruction movement to any extent, you notice that they do like to claim some of the Reformed tradition as being theonomic. It's really not clear. There are certain individuals like Samuel Rutherford, who was a member of the Westminster Assembly from Scotland, can pretty much be shown to be very similar to modern-day theonomists. Dr. Ferguson, in the book that I edited with Bob Godfrey, Theonomy, a Reformed Critique, deals with that issue in his chapter and qualifies it a good bit, but you can go pretty far in the direction of saying Rutherford was like a theonomist. But he was probably a minority at the Westminster Assembly in that regard. Now, the Scots may have been a little more in that direction than the English Puritans. And when you get over to America, the claim was that John Cotton really was a theonomist because he proposed a system of law in Massachusetts that was based on the Mosaic Code. Dr. Logan deals with that one in his chapter in that book. And part of the answer is that Cotton goes pretty far in that direction. The fact is Massachusetts Bay rejected his proposal and modified it because they acknowledged that the Israelite theocracy was different for various reasons from the contemporary situation. And so there had to be a modification. We all Reformed people would look to the judicial law of Israel for principles, for guidelines, as the Westminster Standards say, the general equity thereof still applies, but not in a specific way because of the difference between Old Testament Israel and the time since Christ. Various differences. Mike?
The way I always saw the difference between Lutheran really is the marriage of those.
Yeah, I'm not so sure about the Pharisee-Sadducee thing.
That
the same things are involved here as different between the Lutherans and the Calvinists. I wouldn't want any one-to-one identification. But certainly there is the tendency, as you've suggested it, the Lutherans go in more of an antinomian direction, emphasis on free grace to the point of not emphasizing the law. For Luther, there are two uses of the law. One is, as Paul says, to drive us to Christ, convict us of sin, bring us to the gospel. The other is as a guide to the civil magistrate. For Calvin and the Reformed tradition, there are really three uses of the law, the two that Luther saw, plus that as a model for sanctification. Now, at the same time, Luther does put the commandments into both his catechisms. So obviously, and his last sermons are on Genesis, and he derives a lot from the Old Testament. So as you say, the real commonality is in the Christian liberty area, and Calvin's understanding of that too. I think it's fair to say that Calvin really was more like Luther than he was like Zwingli. But you have in the Reformed tradition, it's not just from Zwingli, but from various areas, this more legalistic type approach that always is a threat. Baxter, for example, sometimes is branded neo-nomian, whereas the Lutherans might be antinomian. So it's and that's because of a peculiar thing in Baxter's theology, even having to do with salvation, his understanding of justification. He imports the law there. But Baxter's not a normal Puritan. He's a maverick in many, many respects. A very interesting one, and one worth reading, but he's a thing unto himself many, many times. But I think what you're saying is right, that both properly understood safeguard against the extremes to which they could go. But you do have those tendencies and those dangers always confronting antinomianism, particularly Lutheranism, and the Reformed tradition more. The Arminian tendency, in some ways, is more to go in the direction of human effort, and including the law. So you have to protect against both sides. Yes, David?
Can I comment on all the readings?
Yes, please. This is a good opportunity to review. Yeah, there are several things to say. One is these things are very hard to gauge. Luther's impression was, towards the end of his life, as you mentioned it, but remember that Luther went through mood swings, too. So how reliable is his own assessment? Lutheranism has certainly come right down to the present, and a lot of it's very sound, biblical Christianity. The Missouri Synod Lutherans are fine people. And so there's a tradition that has maintained a commitment to Christ in a very honorable way. Now, there were departures from Luther, too. They don't emphasize certainly the perseverance of the saints, the fifth point of Calvinism, of the tulip that we'll get to with Synod of Dort, is not part of Lutheranism. And yet Luther himself was very strong on predestination, and the sovereignty of God's grace and salvation. So from a Reformed standpoint, there are many peculiarities in Lutheranism. And I had my kids in Lutheran school for several years, so I have, as I've mentioned, I worship in the summer in Wisconsin at Lutheran Church. So I've been exposed to it. And with the kids in school, they would celebrate their baptismal birthdays. And so the emphasis is put on baptism. They would say, we don't believe in baptismal regeneration as an automatic thing, but sort of like Luther's attitude on the Lord's Supper, it's a mystery. We're not going to try and rationalize it, but it's awfully important that they were baptized, you see, and that is celebrated and remembered. So the emphasis on the sacraments seems to be a little different from what looks like Luther's own experience of conversion. So part of it is Luther, like Zwingli, being at the early stage of the whole thing, where they were still trying to systematize their understanding of the gospel. And Calvin's in a much better position to put it all together. That's part of it. The other thing is that Calvin universalizes the Reformation far better than Luther does. Luther is a German of the Germans, no question about it. I mean, he's a German patriot. You get that sense, even the 95 Theses. This money's going down to Italy. don't let that happen. It's a pastoral concern that people waste their resources, but it's German concern, too. Calvin, for one thing, being a Frenchman, he was a refugee, went to Switzerland. He expresses the Reformation views in much more international terms. And so it's a much more exportable version of the Reformation. You can go to the Netherlands, to Scotland, to Poland, to Hungary, and take hold there without being so defined by one nation. And that's helped it to be more of a missionary version of the Reformation, too. And it could take hold here in America much more readily. As we see when we get to Arminianism, though, the resistance to Calvinism, like that to Luther and the emphasis on grace, is that Arminianism appeals far more to our natural human way of understanding things, to start with our experience. And that's where people resist Calvin, because he starts with God and what God has seen fit to reveal. And most of us with fallen human nature aren't ready to start there. And we've got to learn, even if we don't start there, we've got to get there at some point. And that's why I feel that Reformed people have a lot to contribute to the broader evangelical world. That's why I've been involved with NAE for 8 to 10 years. Here are people who are Bible people. They agree with the scriptures, and they're gospel people, and they're open to what Reformed people have to contribute. And we can learn a lot from them, too. They're a lot better than we are in many ways. But I think it's this part of the Reformed tradition, which is the Augustinian approach, the priority of God and the priority of faith to reason and the priority of scripture to reason and so on, that is helpful to the broader evangelical culture. And I find more and more people whose tradition may be Arminian are really open to that at this point. They're seeking it. So it's a great opportunity for us. Befriend them, get into relationships, dialogue, and we'll learn some things from them in the process too. But the other thing about what you said is that a lot of it is subjective. I mean, I find Luther a very engaging individual too. He's attractive in many ways. And yet if I'd lived there as a contemporary with him, he probably would have blasted me at some point. And Calvin is unless you got to know him real well, he's a more forbidding sort of person externally. And that's sometimes an unfair verdict on him, but that's certainly the way he comes across, and Bainton reflects that. Other comments? Or
Vienna?
They did besiege Vienna in this period.
Looking at it on the map, could you just do a little historical thought? It was really brief in the book.
Yeah. Well, first of all, look at the map here, and you can see the Ottoman Empire extends here. That means, and that includes, you know, what was the Byzantine world, Greece and Macedonia and so forth. This is fairly recent. They conquered Constantinople in 1453, so 65 years or so before Luther's 95 Theses. And this was one of the few times when Islam had their act together. There was a pretty much of a unity, because so often they're subdivided and were rivalry of one another. And then they were somewhat effective militarily, so that they did get all the way up to the siege of Vienna. I'm not sure exactly what dates. Can anybody remember if Bainton indicated 1520s? I know Charles V had to battle them.
It was later.
Yeah, 30s or even 40s towards the end of Luther's life. But Charles V had to be aware of the Turkish threat throughout his reign. Is one of the things that wore him out. The other thing was rivalry with France, and then, of course, Protestantism. He had those three great burdens to deal with, and that's one reason the Reformation was able to proceed, because he's fighting at one point the Turks, another the French, and then he has to focus on Protestantism for a while. The Turks, again, this is like the Holy Roman Empire. It's too big a thing to govern tightly and effectively from a central government at this stage of history. So it's a rather loose thing. They got to Vienna at one point, but they're not always there. They're not a constant threat. Now, the radical reformers who moved to the east, there was obviously less of a church-state domination the farther east they could go, to places like Poland, Hungary, and so forth. Part of it was the attitude of the rulers, but partly the church and the state were not wed as tightly in those areas, because you'd had the Eastern Orthodox Church influential in some of that area, the Balkans and so forth. So the Pope had never gotten quite so strong in some of that Central European area. And also it was a much more agrarian thing, not as urban, so that they could go, there were landed aristocrats who could make use of the labor of these Anabaptist-type people who would come, or the free spirits, And in order to get them to work for them, give them a certain measure of freedom in their religious life, and set up communal places for them to farm and live and so on. So I'm not sure I can give much more detail than that in Eastern Europe, but remember the distances in Europe from an American point of view are not that great. Let's see if we've got a scale here. Here's 400 miles. So you can see the London up to Edinburgh is less than 400 miles, less than from here to Pittsburgh, or a little more than that. Pittsburgh would be about 300 miles. So you can see that here's Wittenberg, and to go out to Warsaw, Poland, or Krakow is less than that. So people could migrate fairly easily. It would take them time, obviously, with a cart, maybe ox drawn, or walking, but they would get there and could move that way. So a little geography is sometimes helpful to realize that these distances, we look at Europe as a continent, but it's a small continent, relatively. Other comments or questions? And Sharon, you may want to pursue that more. I'm not sure I touched on every point you raised. Okay. One of the things I want to bring out is the different solutions to this religious problem. Bainton touches on this, pages 142 and 143. Before we get to that, earlier, 129, they're just an interesting point since we just did the Radical Reformers yesterday. He comments about Sebastian Franck, that he could be at home in any church if permitted, naturally none permitted. I thought that was a typical Bainton comment, wry comment on the times. And he ends up, having been Catholic, having been Lutheran as a layman, making his living by manufacturing soap. Now, 142 and 143 is where he talks about the different solutions to the church-state problem of the time. Three basic ways of resolving this. The Pax Dissidentium, peace among the dissidents. So you get a place like Poland, for example, where you've got four or five different expressions of Christianity as a result of the Reformation coming in, and you find a way of having a government that will tolerate all of these, not giving any one particular favor. Then the second one is territorial division according to the principle of cuius regio, eius religio. One of those handy little Latin expressions. Who's the region, literally, his the religion. So if you've got a Lutheran prince who governs this territory, that will be the religion of that territory. If he's Catholic, it'll be Catholic. But then the others who are different have the freedom to emigrate and go to another. Maybe the adjoining principality is under the other type of religious rule. And so that's that sort of territorial division is another way of solving the problem. This becomes the solution in Germany with the Peace of Augsburg of 1555. That's a real landmark watershed period after Charles has retired. He's burned out, clearly. His brother Ferdinand takes over, and they reach this settlement in Germany of the Lutherans and the Catholics, kind of dividing it up. Basically, the southern part of Germany goes Catholic, the northern part Lutheran. But you can see from this other map what a patchwork quilt the whole thing is. This is at the time, 1547, this would be right after Luther's death. This map here is... This is 1560. I knew there was a date on there somewhere. And this is more to show the religious differences by the colors. The pink is the Lutheran territories, the yellow Catholic. And you can see there'd be Catholic territories surrounded by Lutheran territory, Likewise, some Lutheran territory is surrounded by Catholic territory. The more orange color is Calvinist. This is the Greek church over here. And the green is Anglican. So it's just interesting to see. At 1560, this is after Elizabeth has come to the throne, you still have a predominance of Catholic sentiment to the north and west in England, with Scotland being mostly Calvinist. 1560 is the date, as we'll see, of Knox's influence taking over there. Sam?
Dr. Martin,
yeah, I think there would be an analogy there. One of the things to realize is that the less educated people, peasant class, the humble farming people, who would be the vast majority in Europe still at this time, are going to be slower to change. They're always going to stick with the traditional way far more, even though their level of religious commitment may be fairly superficial. But that's why Catholicism still holds on in many, many places. Some have said that the Reformation really was an urban movement. And it is true, it took hold in the cities first. Not just among the university people, but among commercial people. And not just the leaders of commerce, but for instance, the textile industry was important in England because they were taking the wool of the sheep, and then it was going over to Flanders to be woven into cloth. But there's where there was a lot of back and forth among the merchants. And so the Protestant views.
Yeah.
Right, right. And the word pagan back in the early church, there's some debate as to just what it means, but one meaning of it is country people, like country bumpkins, pagani. And so it reflects the fact that the old religion held on longest among the people in the rural areas. So that's a part of it. And I think my familiarity is greatest with England, the Reformation, and that's pretty much the way. It was in the southeast where the Reformed views were strongest, London and the environs, and then it had to be spread to the north and to the west far more.
Yeah.
Now, sometimes the upper classes also held on to the old ways because they had benefited from them to a great extent. So it was part of holding on to the status quo and tradition. So there are a lot of possible socioeconomic explanations, but they're not never the whole story, because you find many exceptions to the rules, too. To complete this thing about the Pax Dissidentium and then the territorial division, the third way is comprehension. And we talked about that in connection with Elizabeth. To have a political settlement of the church that's broad and includes as many people as possible. And this is what Charles V tried to do, ultimately, and had difficulty pulling it off in a thing as big as the Holy Roman Empire was. A couple other things in the reading to point out to make sure that you get them. Page 152 in Bainton, he talks about the council at Regensburg, 1541. This is the last great effort to get Protestant and Catholic together on theological issues. And Contarini is the cardinal who accepts the doctrine of justification by faith and tries to sell it then back to the papacy and doesn't succeed. And so it falls through. But 1541 is a key date to realize the last efforts to try and really reconcile Protestantism and Catholicism. 1542, the Inquisition is launched the very next year. And you get Paul IV coming to the papal throne in 55. Council of Trent begins in 1543, carries on to 1565. The Jesuits are begun, and so on. So those are important things to see. We've talked about the Peace of Augsburg already. There is reference to the Wittenberg Concord on page 153. He just refers to it as the Concord of 1536. This is sometimes called the Wittenberg Concord, which Bucer negotiated with Luther to get at least brief agreement on the Lord's Supper between Lutherans and Reformed. But it doesn't really last. Charles's interim is described on 154. He had military victory over the Schmalkaldic League and had his chance to impose his settlement. Bucer, as a result, leaves and goes to England. Notice that what they were willing to give was sort of the external things, like communion in both kinds for lay people, wine as well as bread, and marriage of the clergy. And this is the kind of thing the Roman Catholic Church may get to in our day, making certain concessions in areas like that, but not really in the doctrinal area. And notice when the settlements were made, they were always to the disadvantage of the Lutherans or the Protestants, depending on the situation. In other words, you'd get the thing settled so that there'd be toleration of Catholics in Lutheran territory, but not always of Lutherans in Catholic territory. And that probably just reflects what had been the status quo earlier. So the change is hard to get to take place. In France, in this course, don't do justice to the situation in France. That's one of the criticisms I get on student evaluations at the end of the semester. And what I probably should do is bring Bill Edgar in to talk about the Huguenots, because he knows that better than I do. And maybe if time allows and he's willing, we'll do that before the end of the semester. It's a very complex thing, as you can tell from reading what Bainton has to say about it, and McNeil, it's even more complex. All these different changes of kings and rulers. The Guise family is the strongly Catholic noble family, more Catholic often than the royal family is. And then the series of religious wars that go on in this time. We'll have to stop, but just to round out the thing, at least notice that after these series of wars, the one date that's two dates are important. One is the St. Bartholomew's Day Massacre of 1572. It happens to be the same year in which John Knox dies, so we'll talk about that next week. But that's a bad day in Reform circles, St. Bartholomew's Day, which comes in August. Same date. 2,000 ministers are expelled from pulpits in England in 1662, 90 years later. We'll get to that. The other date in the French context that's important is 1598, the Edict of Nantes. Henry IV, who had been Protestant, says it's Paris is worth a mass. He's obviously a politique like Elizabeth, and he gains Paris by converting to Catholicism, at least nominally, but then gives a certain degree of toleration to the Huguenots, the Reformed people, by virtue of the Edict of Nantes. That's a very important date. It gets revoked in 1685 by Louis XIV, which is another era of persecution, which we'll get to before the end. Holland is the other thing. Don't ignore what's there. We'll find other opportunities to talk about that. Okay, Tuesday we'll talk about the Scottish Reformation, and I'll give you more of a clue, perhaps by then, of the midterm.